Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Dresser Show. There's no topic this program is afraid to address or investigate, whether it be social, political, or current events, including some very sensitive cultural issues of today. The views expressed by the host, guest, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Now, step into the realm of clarity with your host, Michael Dresser.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Ken Dunn with us, the author of The Greatest Prospector in the World, that it's a historical accurate parable on creating success in sales, business, and in life. It's going to be available. Let me see what the date is here. It'll be available 3/7/16. Ken's also the CEO and founder of The Next Century Publishing and Reader's Legacy. He's currently leading the charge in changing the way people write, read, and experience books. And after spending 14 years in investigative and tactical policing, Ken was able to hone down deep organizational and leadership skills, but also spark an entrepreneurial fire that lay deep inside. Next Century Publishing has been dubbed by Publishers Weekly as being one of the fastest growing hybrid book publishing companies in the United States. And if that wasn't enough, he also founded Reader's Legacy. And readerslegacy.com is a platform where authors and book lovers come together. Joe Wilkert, a legend in publishing, has noted that readerslegacy.com is to Goodreads like Facebook was to MySpace. And let us say, Ken, I welcome to the show.
Well, thanks a lot, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when you really come down to it, publishing in and of itself, you know, you go back 15 years, maybe 20 years at the most, and if somebody wanted to write a book and publish it, you had to buy 1,000 books, and they all went into your garage, and if you didn't sell them, you still have them. The world is a little different today, isn't it?
Oh, it sure is. And you know what? It's funny you say that because it's really changing right before our eyes. And what you said is accurate. It was worse than that. So 20 years ago, you either got with a big publisher or you got stuck with a vanity publisher, and they wouldn't stop at 1,000. They'd try and convince you to buy 10,000. Copies on a pipe dream, and you could insulate your house with them. Today, you know, there's 75% of people in America that want to write books. Today, sure. An author can get his book published for under $1,000 and be selling it online.
You know, it's amazing. This is an example of what I was talking about. There was somebody I know, and it was right before the second Bush election, and there was something about Bush that he was going to break out into the world. I mean, I'm not doing left or right politics. It's just there was that certain something. And he had it hit done before the election. Something happened, and he didn't get the book published until a week later. Couldn't do it, and the books are still in the garage.
Yep, that's the case most of the time.
Yeah, now, in today's world, you know, if somebody wants to be an author, you can be an author. There's so many great minds out there, so many people with such great ideas. And I think the biggest problem that we have today is they're afraid to take the step. Ken, what do you say to them to take that step?
Yeah, you know, so first of all, I think anybody that is north of 40 years old has a plethora of information that should be in books. Not could be, but should be in books. And I think most people realize that. The challenge, of course, is the proverbial fear of the unknown. But there are so many incredible resources out there today that can help authors to even write their books, that it almost behooves people to do it. As an example, I partnered up 5 years ago with a friend of mine, Nick Boothman, who wrote a book called How to Make People Like You in 90 Seconds or Less, and he sold 2 million copies of that and another 2 million of his subsequent 3 books. And Nick and I started a weekend writing program called Write a Book in a Weekend. The website is writeasaleablebook.com. Somebody can come to our course on Friday at 5 with an idea in their head, work 7 hours Friday night, 10 hours Saturday and Sunday, and by Sunday at 5 o'clock, that book is going to be ready for editing. We'll pull it out of them for them, and it's less than $300 to attend. So there's really no excuses not to do it today.
You know, you said an operative word. You said saleable book. You know, I can't tell you how many times I walked into a group of authors and it said, Okay, sound familiar. I wrote a book. Now what do I do? See, the writing of the book, that's the easy part. I think the real problem is they don't – this is why we need guys like you, because they don't know what to expect after they've written the book. I wrote the book. Now what do I do? That is probably what scares most people. And the word in and of itself, sales, is scary too.
Sure it is. Yeah. You know, first of all, I would move away just slightly from what you said. Just writing the book is not good enough. Just writing the book is not good enough, and it doesn't mean that you're done with it. My next book coming out is my fifth. I wrote it. It took me 2 years to write it. Then I spent 3 years in editing, and I paid editors over $10,000 to get it to the point where people love it. But having said that, once you invest the money to make the manuscript the best it can be, then there's a whole new world of community building that it's not just a nice to have. The bookstores expect it. When I take a book up for an author to a bookstore today and ask the Barnes & Noble rep to buy 1,000 copies and put them in the stores, the very first thing that Barnes & Noble asked me today is, tell me about the author's following. How many people does the author have following them on social media? What is the author doing in the community? Listen to this one. How is the author going to sell this book?
Love it.
The Barnes & Noble doesn't even take responsibility for selling the books anymore.
Sure. You know, because I think when you come down to it, I think we both said the same thing in a different way. You write the book. Now what do you do after the book is written? And I think that's the scary part for most people. But it's like you say, you know, stay in the game, even if you don't want to. There is a way to do this. It's like what you just said, with all of your experience in doing what you do, if I write a book, now I've got what you have to offer. If I read your book on how to write a book, okay, then I've taken a couple hours that you've condensed a lifetime into, and I know what to look out for. That's the key.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Or even simpler than that, I'm a featured writer on Entrepreneur.com and Entrepreneur Magazine, and I write articles on how to write books. And so even if you take 10 seconds to go to Entrepreneur and look up a couple of my articles, Entrepreneur even tells you, look, this article will take 6 minutes to read. Just do some research.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No question about it. I'm an author also, so I've gone through the whole thing. With all, you know, the years of putting it together, everybody looking at it and say, do it this way. And then finally, a good friend of mine read the book again, and he said, that's not you. You know, he said, this is not what I read 3 years ago. And then I had to redo the whole thing. I think when it comes down to it, you've got to stay true to yourself and find the people that will back you up.
Yeah, I agree with that. That and you have to just be humble enough to realize that books that are written so that it comes from your mouth are not necessarily the ones that sell. The ones that sell are the ones that are written for the reader. And it takes an expert eye to do that. You just, look, it is a daunting task to sell a lot of books today. I know my Greatest Prospector in the World book is going to become a bestseller. Why? Because it's my fifth book. Why? Because I have over 100,000 people following me on social media. Why? Because every time I publish an article on Entrepreneur Magazine, I get at least 5,000 shares of the articles by people I don't even know. Why? Because I'm going to speak 21 times for major corporations that are paying me to speak on the 6 great prospecting secrets from the book in the next 12 months. You've got to build a following.
Yeah, Ken, what it comes down to, you said it, I'm going to say it in a different way. I'm going to become Ken Dunn for a moment. I'm you, my book, okay? You're the person I want to reach out there. Ask me what my book is about.
Yeah, what's your book about, Ken?
It's about you.
There you go.
Yeah, and that's really what the key is. If it's not about me, your listening audience, I'm not going to listen to you. And that's the key. All people, you know, audiences like people. We want to hear about ourselves. We want to know why. We're going to know how. We're going to benefit from what you're trying to offer. And that in and of itself is the total magic. If it's not about me, I'm not going to listen. And if it's about me, I will hear you say something, whether I'm 5 rooms over having fun at a card table.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that, Mike, because my personal coach is Nick Boothman. He's my speaking coach and also my writing coach. And he taught me something years ago that he now teaches at our classes. When people say, what's your book about? We actually teach people to say exactly what you just said with just one slight addition, and it's a question. So somebody says to me, what's your book about? I'm going to say, it's about you. And then they're going to say, what do you mean? And I'm going to say, well, have you ever had a time when you've needed to try and convince somebody to do something, but you've struggled and it's made you feel icky? Of course we know the answer is yes. And
sure.
Then I'll go on to say, well, this book teaches people how to make other people feel comfortable about new ideas. And
yeah.
So we've presented the problem and answered it, but it's all focused on the person.
Sure. And let me add something to that also. And another, you know, you've heard time and again how critically important stories are when you're going to illustrate a particular point. But one of the
yeah.
most important things about a story basically is this. I'm going to give you a crude example. Bear with me. You do a live presentation. You're all done. You're standing outside. One of your target audience members walks out and calls you stupid. Well, let's say you're the kind of guy that takes offense to this. So the arguing,
uh-huh.
the bannering, and the noise back and forth, you're at each other. Not a pretty sight. Scenario one. Scenario two. You and I are sitting down having a cup of coffee. I'm talking about other guys just like you, same family values, same upbringing, same education, same goals, same across the board. And I'm talking about some of the things that they were doing that were stupid, and you recognized you were doing some of the same things. Ken, there's where the magic is. You can't tell anybody anything anymore. They won't listen to you. But if you frame
right.
a third party and you let them look at it from the outside in and make the decision themselves, all of a sudden the magic begins.
Amen.
Yeah, totally. And I really believe when you're illustrating, that's what it comes down to. Now, constantly ask questions. This also, I think, is important coming from someone like you. We ask the wrong questions. We get the right answers for the wrong questions, and we're down a path that we just don't get any clarity out of. So if you go to somebody like you who's been there and done it, you teach people what questions to ask.
Oh, absolutely. That speaks on two different levels. So number one, when I'm teaching sales training, The Greatest Prospector in the World is a wonderful fiction parable about a little girl named Laura Dunnigan growing up in 1912 in the city of Chicago. And she has to learn how to be a salesperson. And one of the first things her Uncle Joe teaches her is how to assume rapport. This is the secret art of the world's greatest prospectors. The assuming rapport means to go up to somebody who you don't know, who looks like a great prospect, and get into the conversation as if they're already your best friend. If you
yeah.
and I are best friends and we meet out on the street and we haven't seen each other in ages, we're not going to go out and get into the niceties, the salutations. We're going to get right into the conversation. As example,
yeah.
we could be sitting and looking at a beautiful view over a parking lot, and I walk right up to a stranger and say, my gosh, this is the most beautiful view I've ever seen. Or you could follow up with that and say, what's the name of that river? And that question in itself elicits and starts a conversation on neutral ground. So that's
sure.
step one, how to break the ice and build a relationship. But the second also revolves around asking great questions. It's understanding that nobody will ever buy from you unless they know you, like you, and trust you. And if we work that in reverse order, it starts with developing like. Now, of course, us in the sales training world know that one person will develop an opinion of another person within the first 2 seconds of the interaction.
If it takes that long, yeah.
Exactly. Now, if we're going to get somebody to like us with the intent to get them to buy from us, then we need to focus on what is the one thing in the world that every single person in the world enjoys talking about. It's themselves.
Sure.
And so if you start off your sales process, your interaction, your prospecting process, whatever you want to call it, with expressing a genuine interest in that person with which you're trying to prospect and asking them questions with a desire to get to know them better, you're going to jump leaps and bounds towards your goal.
Sure. And by the way, when they get a little older, a great question to ask is you walk up and you say, hey, what meds are you on?
or what time in the afternoon do you take your nap?
Yeah, there you go. But it's true. It's that familiarity. They have to know
sure
that
is.
You know. That's really where the key is. It's like I can't tell you how many times I've walked into a room with authors and saying, sound familiar? Remember thinking, gee, I wrote a book. I wonder if anybody will buy it. But you know the answer to that. At some level, they've thought that before. There's the familiarization. That's the empathy that they know that you know. And if they know you know, they'll open up to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, now, the right tools. There are, you know, in like anything, sales, marketing, it's even writing a book, it doesn't come naturally. There's a skill to all of it. How do you find the right tools? What do you use?
Well, you know, that's in my book, The Greatest Prospector in the World. We actually talk about the six secrets, if you will, the six tools, the six ideals that were imparted from Uncle Joe to Laura in the sales prospecting process. And, of course, one of them is using the right tools. And it was kind of metaphorically stated. The bottom line is you have to be organized. If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. And so in order for me to purport that I'm one of the greatest prospectors in the world, I need to be. I'm a phenomenal salesperson. But I find that I'm don't take no for an answer. I'm doggedly determined, and I'm organized. I keep notes. I have journals. I use software to keep track of my leads. I realize that I am myself the greatest tool. I am the icebreaker, if you will. And I have to know what the products are. Whatever you're selling, in any industry, if you're not a personal consumer of the products you're selling, you're probably selling the wrong thing.
Sure.
The tools are so important.
Yeah, no, and when you really come down to it, the being prepared, the having the tools, having the skills, and being able to back up, because when you really come down to it, people lean on you. You know, when you're selling something, they're leaning on you also. I've also found this over years and years and years and years. Is that there's no such thing as no. The only reason you get a no is you haven't come up with a compelling reason to buy. So you get a no, what they're saying to you, you haven't asked me the right question. You haven't presented me what it is that I need to hear before I take the next step. And when you come down to it, everybody in the world gets sold one way or another. If you're married, you ask your wife, your fiance, will you marry me? Sales is offer and acceptance. You made an offer. She said yes or no. She said yes, you sold her.
Absolutely. Couldn't disagree with a word you said there.
Yeah, and by the way, when we talk about sales, I really believe that people have the wrong impression or definition of that word. You're not a used car salesman going to sell somebody something that's not going to work 10 minutes after they buy it. And it's a very scary word. But without it, where would we be in the world, in politics, in life, in relationship? Where would you be without sales?
Sales is everything we do in our lives.
Yeah.
It is every single thing we do in our lives.
No, that's true. Because when you come down to it, it's, what are you going to do for me? And I think the biggest problem with most people in sales is this. I have worked out all my life. I'm no Schwarzenegger, but I work out. And I go into a gym, they have a machine. The machine's going to give me a big bicep. Okay, so the machine is the feature. The benefit is I get a big bicep. So did anybody ask me why I want a big bicep? No. What do they care? But I want a big bicep because I want to go out to the beach and show off to the girls. So don't sell me the machine. Don't sell me the bicep. Sell me the beach. And I think there's where the problem is.
Correct. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, when you really come down to it. Okay, now, dress for the weather. What are we dealing with?
Well, again, you know, it's a whimsical story, so we had to come up with an ideal that was related to the old days of prospecting. And in the storybook, Laura's dad in the early days used to remind her that she'd have to dress for the climate. You'd go into the river sometime in the middle of January in Alaska, and it would be sub-zero, and you'd be prospecting for gold. You had to make sure you were prepared. And such is true in prospecting and selling. If you're selling farm equipment to farmers, dress like a farmer. If you're selling real estate, dress appropriately. It's all about making sure that you're aligned with your environment. Look good, feel good, smell good, dress good. You don't get a second chance to make that first impression.
No, you don't. Okay, and again, let me ask you this. We're just about out of time. So, website we can find you at and get the book.
Yeah, thank you for that. Best website in the world to find me at is kendunn.org. Everything about me and the book is there. But you can also check me out at readerslegacy.com. It's a fun, socially engaged social media platform for people that love books.
Okay, by the way, when is the book coming out?
It's going to be available on March 16th, 2017. Sorry, 2016.
That sounds like a space movie, doesn't it?
Yeah, it may be.
I can't believe we're that far yet. Okay, Ken, hey, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Good day.
Trey. Trey. You want me just, how detailed do you want this bio to be? Oh, sorry. You're not Trey. He just went that way.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Judith Hannon with us, the author of The Right Prescription, Telling Your Story to Move with and Beyond Illness. She's the author of Motherhood Exaggerated, her memoir of discovery and transformation during her daughter's cancer treatment and her transition into survival. Her essays have appeared in such publications as Women's Day, Oprah News, The Huffington Post, The Healing Muse, and on she teaches writing about personal experience to homeless mothers and at-risk adolescents, as well as to medical students, and is a judge of the annual essay contest sponsored by the Arnold P. Gold Foundation for Humanism in Medicine. She is also a frequent speaker of medical professionals for whom she seeks reveal the hidden parts of patient stories. She's got a long-time history of involvement in children's education, health and welfare. She served as director of development of the 92nd Street Y and then for the Children's Museum of Manhattan. She now serves on the board of the museum, Jody Olderfield Dance Projects, as well as three boards affiliated with the Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York. And let us say, Judith, I welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when you really come down to it, the right prescription, you know, telling your story to move with and beyond illness, there are so many people who have so much to offer, and yet they hold it back.
Right. Well, I think that one of my objectives, first let me just give a little description of what the book is.
Sure.
So I was, you can see I used writing for myself when my daughter was ill, and I found that that process very, very transformative. And because I'm also a teacher, I wanted to find a way to combine the healing properties that writing has and help people to tell stories. And the reason why I say beyond illness is because I think it's important to put the illness within the context of your larger life so that your life doesn't just become the illness.
Sure.
So the book is a series of personal reflections, writing samples, and then exercises that people can do. Some of them are strictly about how to, you know, be a better writer, certain tools that you can use, and some of them bring you directly into the scenes of your illness experience, but also to say, well, what else is happening in my life and what else is happening in the world? And there's also a chance for people to think about and write about the doctor-patient relationship, the use of technology in medicine, kind of more op-ed kind of pieces. So that's basically what the book is. And
see, most importantly, you said, the healing process and writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For most people, for most of us, if you don't write it down, there are things that you won't see. And by writing it down, things unconsciously start to come up. It allows you to take a look at the reality of, quote-unquote, sometimes why it happened and how you dealt with it as it was happening. And it really tells you about yourself.
Right. And I think what writing can do that speaking can't do is that when you're speaking, at least when I am, I feel like I'm very involved with myself and I'm very in myself. But when I write, as much as I'm getting into my feelings and my gut and things like that, writing, you're always kind of standing next to yourself. And
yeah,
that little bit of remove while you're writing is kind of comforting when you're writing about very difficult things. I know from my own experience and from working with people who have gone through trauma that while they're writing, their faces are very calm. You have no idea what's getting put onto the page. They, you know, look almost passive. And then when they read, it's a totally different experience. They get emotional. Their voices shake. They cry. And so writing allows them to say what they wouldn't have been able to get out if they had gone straight to the speaking part of it.
Two kinds of minds there. You got your conscious mind, and you have your subconscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put it out on paper, your unconscious, your conscious mind is all those literal things in your life, your thinking, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But your unconscious mind deals in a language of pictures and symbols. It doesn't have
right.
a language. Its language, again, well, its language is the pictures and symbols. Each one of those pictures and symbols holds a corresponding emotion, good,
yeah,
bad, or indifferent. It
mm-hmm.
holds it there, and you respond to it. When you write, you tap into that unconscious, and those things that you normally don't see come to the table, and that's when you get to deal with it, you really get to know what it is that drives your decisions in life.
Right, exactly. And what I find is, you know, people say, oh, I can't write, I can't do that. And so really what I try and do is to break things down for people so that they're not right. You kind of... you only want to do like small bits at a time. Just take a very small thing. You don't have to write your whole story. You don't have to have it plotted out from the beginning to the end. It's just one simple exercise at a time. And so for people who find, writers have a hard time writing. So
sure,
the effort, the attempt with the right prescription is to say, okay, just do this. And here's a
yeah.
little tool that you can use, and then all of a sudden you're, like you say, you're putting words to these pictures and symbols that are coming from your gut as opposed from your brain.
A great example of that, and we've all done this. You walk into a room, and you ever done this? You walk into a room and you see somebody you don't like. You've never seen them before.
Right.
You have no idea who they are, man or woman. You just don't like them. All right, but that's the key to what we're talking about. You'll never literally, logically figure out why you don't like them.
Mm-hmm.
But symbolically, if you sat down and wrote it down, it would come to the fore. You'd find out what it is about this person that reminds you of something or someone else in your life that, you know, was a turnoff. That's where the key is. It's the same
thing.
Well,
I actually have an exercise in the very beginning of the right prescription that's like that, that uses a stream of consciousness to say, like, so kind of like how I got here. So it's really just listening to your first impression of something. So you think of that, and then you see where that takes you, where that takes you, and then it does. It gets you to the point, okay, now I know why I don't like that person. That's the association
yeah.
that I've made with that person. And you kind of have to unlock your disconnect your brain from your heart in order to do that. And stream of consciousness is great for that.
Give you a prime example of that. Years and years and years ago, I sat down with a woman and we were having a cup of coffee. And I mentioned that my father had passed away. My father died when I was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to me, oh, you were rejected. I said, what do you mean rejected? He died. She said, the opposite of acceptance is rejection. And then it hit me. The first two women that I really loved when I was young, I drove them out. Why? To prove that they're going to leave me. And that's that was that unconscious motivation that I would have never realized until she said that day, or if I would have done the process that you're talking about and sat down and wrote it down.
So that's kind of what happened to me when I wrote Motherhood Exaggerated. So, you know, I started writing that book, or I didn't know it was a book. I just started writing because that's what I do when I'm faced with that kind of thing. And it was very raw, and it was, you know, it wasn't angry, but it was raw.
Sure.
And then, like, 3 years later, I thought I had a book, and I was being honest, and I, like, brutally honest, and I was just being brutal. I was not being compassionate to the other characters in the story, my husband being one of them. And I realized that as I wrote, I had this narrative in my head from growing up that I was somehow poor little Judy. And as I'm writing this book and I'm being pressed to write more about my own experience as a child, because the book is partially about how the way I was raised affected how I was raising my children. And as soon as I was told, you know, you're not very nice, and the way you talk about your mother isn't very nice. And my mother loved me, and I loved my mother, and I realized that it was just, but I had this narrative in my head that I was poor little Judy. And it was only through the writing of this book that I came to a whole other definition of my relationship with my mother and started to understand her, because she died when I was 30, and I never really thought about the fact that it wasn't just that I was mourning her, but while she was dying, she was mourning as well. She wasn't ever going to see her family again. So, you know, I couldn't have gotten to that point without writing.
No, absolutely. Now, we have common barriers. What are some of those that we face when we tell our story? And especially about illness. What are those things that we want to back away from, not want to stand up and face?
Right. Well, you know, nobody wants to face their mortality, that's for sure.
No.
And I think as a parent, when I was writing, what I didn't want to face was the fact that I couldn't control this. My job as a mother was to keep my children safe, and I wasn't able to do that. And that's the way life is. I mean, there are just things that we can't control. But it was very hard, since I took that role so seriously, to realize that I wasn't able to control that. But I could control what I wrote. And so that was also very important. And I found that, so my mother died when I was 30. My father died a year and a half ago, and I'm 62 now. So I'm just kind of, the growth that I've gone through that time, the way I responded to how my mother died versus how my reaction to my father and the role that I played was so very different. And that's actually something that I'm writing about now, is what it means to be a caregiver, because, you know, stories about illness aren't just for the patient. The whole family is affected, and how important it is to be a caregiver. What that does for the person, like with my mother, I don't want to get too all psychological here, but with my mother, I didn't have that opportunity, and it was one experience. With my father, I did have that opportunity, and it was a very different experience, and one that left me more settled afterwards. So, and these are things that I'm working out now through writing.
Sure, but and caregiving in and of itself is a whole different topic that, you know, to get into. You know, caregiving, I interviewed someone, and I'll never forget what she said. She said, caregiving can happen in seconds. I mean, you know, you're married, all of a sudden there's an accident, there's something,
right.
And you're dealing with somebody, and you've got them in the bathroom, you're cleaning them up, and 10 seconds later they want sex. So you've got, there are all of these things that you have to take a look at when you're dealing with caregiving. And there are a lot of people who decided not to live because of it. So that's a whole other area to get into. That's not just, you know, bring somebody dinner.
Yeah. I mean, I do have some exercises in the right prescription where the same exercise can be done by the patient and the caregiver. And if they want to, they can compare notes and see how each one viewed a situation, because perspective is really important part of everything. And I think it's always really important not, you know, to see to write a story from the other person's perspective, or to hear the story from another person's perspective, or sometimes I'll say, write your story, but in the third person. And as soon as you substitute the word I with the word she, it takes you to a completely different place. So the perspective piece of things is really important, as is the context. I mean, I would say the first time I wrote Motherhood Exaggerated, the first draft, it was just about illness. It was about hospitals, and it was about IVs, and it was about scars, and it wasn't about people. And as soon as I started inserting, well, what was my relationship with Nadia beforehand, and how is it being affected, and how am I changing as a mother? Well, I have to look at what kind of mother I was. I have to look at how I was mothered. I had to look at my relationship with my husband and my two other kids. So the best, I think, narratives on illness are ones that really bring in this whole context, because it takes the writer someplace. It'll take the reader someplace.
Oh, blame letters are good, too. Do the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, instead of, you know, because of you, I did this, because of you, and then all of a sudden turn it around, and you got a whole different world out there.
Exactly.
And I think the biggest problem, whether it's health, wealth, whatever the case may be, relationship, we don't take responsibility for our actions.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control what comes into your life. It's going to come in. But you can control how you deal with it.
Exactly.
Prime example, and this happened accidentally, 20 years ago, I got diagnosed with some disease. And I had to have an operation, and I knew that I had to be in the best physical condition that I could possibly be in. So I'm done my exercise cycle. I'm running up and down hills, and I'm in the garage one day, and I'm on the I'm on one of those stationary bikes, and I'm pedaling away and sweating, and then it hit me. I made it okay to die. I didn't say I want to die.
Right.
I made it okay to die. And the minute I did that, the stress went.
Yeah.
And the minute the stress went, I think the immune system kicked in, and that's probably what saved me 20 years ago.
Wow, that's very, very powerful.
Yeah.
I was talking to a friend of mine today who did some writing exercises. When I do readings with my book, I sometimes give people assignments to write at the reading. So I had given this prompt, which was to pick a whatever mood or emotion you're feeling at the time and to name it after a person. And I used an example that I use, because I always find it's easier to talk to a person than it is to a feeling, and this comes from a meditation practice that I do. And I was talking about the feeling of grief and how I named my grief Greta, and I described what Greta looked like and how I could walk with her and take her to the ocean and things like that. And so a woman did this exercise with me, and she talked about anxiety and called it Layla. And she had this whole conversation with Layla where by the end of it she was able to say, you know, Layla, you can come knock at my door, but I don't have to let you in. And, you know, I get to control who you are. And it just reminds me of the reason why I mention it. It's like this revelation where you have control over something. You have the control over, your attitude towards death, and you can control whether you're going to let anxiety in. You know, it sounds simple, and I don't know if we can all sustain this all the time, but it's definitely a helpful way to cope with the things that scare us the most.
But that's the key. Most of life and the survival mechanisms are simple, but we make them so complex that we worry about what's going to happen 2 months from now, five years ago, and we never stay right here and control what's going on. And I think that's extremely important, but it's that, you know, we keep hearing people say in the now.
Mm-hmm.
That's so critically important. That's not airy-fairy sitting under a tree going, you know,
right.
My colors, man.
No, it's
reality.
It is reality, or as a lot of Buddhists would say, there is no reality, but it's our reality, let's put it that way. No, I totally agree with that, and that's... I do meditate, and I will say I'm not always successful. I'm rarely successful during my whole meditation time doing that, but I can do it when I write. You know, I can forget that I have a headache. I can forget that I'm nervous about something. You know, those things do happen to me when I'm writing, and with music too. I would say music has that ability with me also.
But you just said you can forget about the headache.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's not there, is it?
Right, exactly.
It's what you concentrate on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when most of us are completely oblivious to everything around us.
Yeah.
You want a good example of that?
Yes.
Okay. Are you sitting by a desk?
I'm not.
Okay. Are you on a chair?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Touch the chair.
Okay.
Okay. Now, before you touched that chair, it didn't exist, did it?
I suppose I wasn't thinking about it very much, right?
Right. It was there. I mean, there's no question. But
right.
It didn't exist. It wasn't there. And that's what life is, for the most part, like. You don't touch it. It's there.
Right.
You don't see it. It's not part of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's. And when I ask people to write, and again, this is part of the book as well. I'm very, very adamant that people use all of their senses when they write. That when you're setting a scene, it's not what happened. It's what was there. What did you see? What did you hear? What did you feel? What did you smell? You know, what did you touch? What were the sounds? You know, so someone's giving you a diagnosis, so you relate that. But what else is going on? The doctor's sitting there, and you see that his sock has fallen down, and you can see his ankles, and they're ugly. Or there's dust in the corner, or there's a noise coming from down the street, or someone just brought in a bucket of French fries. I mean, whatever it is, to bring those details into the scene gives it a much richer context. And it's like you have to pay attention. You know, that's really what it is. You have to pay attention.
Well, isn't that the same thing with kids and
mm-hmm.
people in your life? You got to pay attention. You got to touch them. Otherwise, they don't exist. And they know when they don't exist in your life. And you say, you don't pay attention to me. And you say, what do you mean I don't pay attention? No, you don't.
Yeah. That's
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Anyway, Judy, we're just about out of time.
Okay.
So let me ask you this.
Sure.
Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes. My website is www.judithhannanwrites.com. It's J-U-D-I-T-H-H-A-N-N-A-N, judithhannanwrites.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us. And if somebody missed it, it's up on our website.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Take care.
Okie doke. You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. Welcome back, Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Denise Pankhurst with us, author of The Virgin Diabetic, Learning to Live with Diabetes. The U.S. government provides information for diabetics to manage and cope with type 2 diabetes. Doctors follow suit by prescribing dangerous drugs for the disease. Denise is an expert on type 2 diabetes. She says that the deadly effect of type 2 can be reversed. In fact, she says that type 2 diabetes does not need to exist. It can be reversed, it can be avoided, and by moving ourselves from this carb-overloaded era we live in, today, as a matter of fact, if you listen to this, over 150 million Americans become diabetic or pre-diabetic. And major examples, processed food, fast food, and it goes on and on and on. And let us say, Denise, I welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me on today.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, there's so many people that are diabetic. Even if they're not diabetic, they're diabetic. And it's got to a point now where does somebody really know if they are or not? I mean, if you get diagnosed, is that diagnosis really something that you can guarantee yourself with?
You know, I think the way we're all living today, It's a, almost a guarantee for many millions of people. Probably at least 5 million a year are being diagnosed, and they're moving from that pre-diabetic to diabetic stage. And I can tell you, for me personally, when I was pre-diabetic, I thought making some of those small lifestyle changes, exercising, you know, don't eat those fried foods, that was going to help. And what I did not realize is that I was too far into that disease. And either, to me, you're either diabetic or you're not. I don't know if there's really a true reason to call it pre-diabetes, because too many of us move into that diabetic stage.
Okay, now, you're a holistic nutritionist and obviously a diabetic coach and the author. Now, food, it's critical. You know, most people think, okay, eat something, it's, you know, it's got carbs, it's got protein, it's got this. But obviously food in and of itself is going to direct the degree to health that you're going to be in your life.
You are absolutely correct. Food is the driving force for everything in our health, whether it is diabetes or some other disease. Everything comes from our gut. And so if our bodies cannot process the nutrients that we're supposed to give it, well, it puts us in a diseased state. So it really is important that we really need to learn as a country to have whole fresh foods in our diet and take out the fast food, take out all of those processed foods.
Yeah, because when it comes down to it, it's attitude towards everything, attitude towards food, attitude towards disease. I remember years ago I got sick and they told me I had XYZ, and the first thing out of my mouth is, how do you fix this thing? See, that's the key. It's being able to get a handle on what it is that you've got and then find out how to get it or how to fix it. Now, for you, right after being diagnosed with a type 2 diabetes, what was your reaction? What did you do?
Oh, my gosh. I was devastated. And for me, I was, you know, I was a size 6 when I got married, and in my 40s, I was a size 8. So I was not an obese person, which is mm-hmm. what most of us would tie that to. But it was my, you know, Italian background, Americanized Italian background.
Yeah.
My lifestyle put me into type 2 diabetes. So I was absolutely devastated. My father passed away from diabetes and heart disease. And I also had an uncle who was a diabetic amputee. So this was close to me. And
yeah.
I thought, oh, I'm going to avoid it. I'm tiny. That's great. I'm healthy. Come to find out, I was living the American lie. And I really had to come to grips with the fact that I really had control and I let it go. I really did not take it, my health, seriously enough by the time I hit my 40s.
Yeah, and by the way, that is so true. We have, you know, what drives me crazy is these ads are on television. If you take, first off, you see this thing that says XYZ, and this prescription will make you feel good, and it will cure all the demons inside of you. Then 3 years later, you see the same thing that says if you've taken XYZ, and if you've felt like you were going to kill yourself or somebody else died, we'll sue them and get some money for you. And then they give you all of these side effects, going crazy, losing your blood, yada, yada. It's got to a point now where you almost don't even know what to take anymore, because you don't know if 2 years later it's going to be on the television and we're going to sue somebody for it.
Oh, you're absolutely right. In the exact same process happened to me on the oral medication that I had been prescribed. I went to the pharmaceutical website to research and see what it was my doctor prescribed for me, and I look and see that it causes heart disease, it causes bladder cancer, it could cause brittle bones in women. So all the things that we certainly do not want going against our health were the things that this medication was promoting and pushing
yeah.
people into. So when I stopped taking it, the FDA actually put a black box warning on that particular medication. And I looked at my doctor and said, I have no desire to take anything like this. And doctors are shocked when you do that.
Sure.
They don't know how to react. And that is, I think, something that we need to work on with our medical community.
Doctors have the last word. They're the ones that I'm being facetious when they say this. And I respect doctors. There's no question about it. But if the doctor says that, that's what it is. People are frightened to death to do something different than the doctor says.
Oh, absolutely. And I was very frustrated with the medical community. What I came to learn and what I teach in my coaching, it's really a team effort for you to either regain your health and then maintain it. None of us can really do it alone. It really takes a team of good people to do that. So we truly need our doctors to be our advocates and our guide, but we have to remember we are the leader for our health. No one's going to take a better interest in our health than we can.
No, absolutely. And when you come to, you know, conventional medicine, or traditional, it comes down to people are afraid to step above and beyond experience. But I think doctors today are taking a look at natural health. They're taking a look at alternatives that they wouldn't look at before. Not all of them, but some of them are.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, funny enough, I believe some of our doctors are actually learning from their patients. And I think it's a good cohesive relationship if we can learn from each other and really move us into optimal health. I think that should be our goal.
Absolutely. And how can you not learn from somebody coming in with a problem? You know, and is there commonality of what's causing the problem? Is there commonality of what's keeping the problem? Is there commonality of what's making the problem go away? I mean, the list can go on and on. So absolutely, we learn back and forth. Now, when you got a hold of it, the light bulb came on, and all of a sudden you were going to reverse this this type 2. What was it that made you make that decision?
Well, I can tell you there were at least two main factors. One, taking 4 insulin shots per day is not fun. I found myself in tiny little bathrooms in a restaurant. It was horrible. And I think anyone who's done it can attest to that. But the other piece was where no one shared with me in advance, as I tried to bring exercise back into my life and take the shots and try to eat the foods I was told to eat, I realized my glucose levels were like a roller coaster ride. And when I would exercise, my glucose level could drop anywhere from about 20, 25 points to 100 points. And that can put you into a hypoglycemic state, so where your glucose, your sugar level, is just too low. It's dangerous. And that was my defining moment when I said, okay, look at the root of the problem. That's the insulin. But I needed the insulin to survive. And then I thought about it, do I really? Because I'm eating certain foods that are making me take that insulin. And that was when I had that defining moment. I had the answer.
Okay, so in essence, when you eat something, food is chemical anyway. Any way you look at it, it turns to chemical. So if we look at what we eat, and we find out what it turns into and the specific effect that particular food has on our body, all of a sudden the world looks different, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It looks absolutely different. And I have to tell you, had I known this 10 or 15 years earlier, I completely could have avoided even being a diabetic. I mean, this is a disease that can be avoided if you feed your body the proper nutrition. And we are talking type 2 diabetes versus a type 1.
Yeah. Oh, well, okay, what's the difference between the two?
Well, type 2 is typically lifestyle-induced, where type 1, they look at it as an autoimmune disease. The pancreas is not producing the insulin, which typically starts in child age, you know, 10 to 19 in that range. But not to say that proper food will help them anyway. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, but proper food will still help a type 1 diabetic. It will not cure or reverse, but it definitely can be reversed with your type 2 diabetes.
You know, you mentioned something early on about, you know, we learn from each other, et cetera. But when you come down to it, the best thing that ever happened to you in your life was the diagnosis of diabetes.
You know, crazy enough, yes.
you wouldn't be here.
Right.
You wouldn't be here. Yes. You wouldn't be helping the people that you help and saving lives out there.
Yes, I completely agree with you, and my husband even told me, do something good with it. And he was absolutely right on, and I have to tell you, the pleasure I get when I hear people tell me that they're off their medication, their doctors are happy, their doctors say, keep doing whatever it is you're doing. There's excitement, true excitement, not like we see on those commercials for all of the medication, but true excitement.
Sure.
And that makes me absolutely happy that I have a hand in helping all these people to improve their health.
Yes. Okay. Now, let's go back when somebody is testing for diabetes. Blood tests, how critical are they?
You know, blood tests are very important. They do give you a good baseline of where your health is at that moment in time. So because diabetes also can put people into heart disease, we definitely want to be able to have several different tests. And one of them is called an A1C or a hemoglobin A1C. That will test your glucose levels for a period of about the last 60 to 90 days. It gives an average of where your glucose levels are at. Are you at normal or above normal? And so that's a very critical one to have, as opposed to what we call a fasting glucose. That would be measuring your glucose level before you've started to eat any meals during the day. So that would be something in the morning. And then also you do want to have some cholesterol testing. There is a test out there called a cardio IQ, and that to me is the best test you can get for cholesterol because it measures many different levels of your lipids, and it also measures the size and the pattern of your cholesterol. So we want to know, is your cholesterol healthy or not healthy? And that combined with your A1C, if you can't afford any testing, the A1C and the cardio IQ are the two I highly recommend.
Hmm. Okay, now, this is, I want to make sure we get this. What's the takeaway for today? What do we walk away from today's show?
You know, today what I'm really hoping that people learn is that you truly have the ability to take control of your health. You don't have to be a medical practitioner and have gone to school for years. You can take interest. There's enough information on the internet. There are, you know, even on my website, reversemydiabetes.net, there's some information in there to get people going to start understanding the questions they need to ask their doctor, and that you can turn your diabetes around. A worst-case scenario, if you cannot completely reverse it, you can make drastic changes that will only help you with your health throughout the rest of your life. And most diabetics can lose 10 years off their life. I want to save those people and give them their 10 years back.
Wonderful. And by the way, Denise, there's a free report on your website, right?
There is a free report on my website, so anyone that goes to reversemydiabetes.net, if they go to my contact page and just say, I want the free report, just let me know you are listening to me on the Michael Dresser Show, and I'm happy to send that out immediately.
Wonderful. And also, you do one-to-one coaching over the phone, right?
Yes, I do. And my program is an 8-week program, holds you by the hand. And anyone, again, of your listeners that are interested, again, go to my contact page at reversemydiabetes.net. And I am willing to deduct $100 off of my coaching price for anyone who signs up in November, because November, I want to honor National Diabetes Awareness Month.
Aha. Great. Okay, now, by the way, we're just about out of time, so one more time, please, with your website.
My website is reversemydiabetes.net.
Okay, one last question. How close was I to pronouncing your last name?
You were pretty close. It's actually Panzers.
Oh, Panzers.
But Panzers, but that's quite all right. It was close enough for me.
I love it. Okay, Denise, hey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Dr. William Motto with us, author of The Solution, A Blueprint to Change and Happiness. Dr. Motto has been recognized by Psychology Today magazine as one of America's best therapist. He's a psychotherapist in private practice, a college professor, consults to various organizations and school districts, and has been a guest on numerous radio and TV shows. And let us say, William, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it. It's great to be a guest.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, when you're talking about the solution, that blueprint to change and to happiness, you know, we go down our path of life and we get hit on the head. We keep going back and we repeat the same old problems over and over again. Where is there that point where somebody can actually stand up, take a look at what's going on, and make that change?
I think, first let me say this. I'm no stranger to Wisconsin. I used to work for Johnson Controls and off in Milwaukee, always in great town. A lot of people in therapy, they have to hit their rock bottom. They might be depressed or so anxious or having panic attacks, and now they're seeking help or they want to, read self-help books.
And now I understand you do a lot with hypnotherapy.
I do. It's off the topic a little bit, but there's a lot of misunderstanding about hypnosis. Nothing to do with sleep. You hear things loud and clear, totally in control. But many people, and you're hypnotized every day. The best example is you're driving along a landmark going by and you forget about them. When you focus your attention on something, you become hypnotized. It's a focusing of attention, but a lot of people are suggestible and they tend to follow through on post-hypnotic suggestions. In fact, in the book, I put all the benefits of meditation in there.
Someone once said to me years ago, they said, the definition of hypnosis in a hypnotist job is not to hypnotize, but is to de-hypnotize, bring down the level of suggestibility to whatever is going on at the time. Because when you come down to it, I think we all walk around in that state. And a great example of that is go to a movie. You've got trained and skilled actors and actresses on that screen. Part of that learned skill is knowing what they do and what they say will bring about intentional results. You're crying, you're laughing, you're in love, you're frightened, you're angry, and you're going through all of these emotions, and it's up on a big screen, you know it's not real. And if you haven't taken a suggestion, then something's wrong here.
What I find, this is like I saw from my third book, people that have anxiety, panic attacks, post-traumatic stress are suggestible. Because if they weren't, they wouldn't be in that state. And about 35% of the population is suggestible. And they tend to follow, even, this is interesting, I think ADD people are very suggestible, believe it or not. And they tend to follow through on post-hypnotic suggestions. You're not asleep, you hear things loud and clear. They should call it mesmerism, nothing to do with sleep whatsoever.
Sure. Now, by the way, one of the things in the solution, you say that thoughts have actual physical properties and can actually make or break us. Now, what do you mean by that statement, broken down on a level that most of us can understand?
Yeah. Real simply, I'll make this brief. There's part of the brain called the limbic system, and that's the center for emotional processing. Habitual negative thoughts produces chemicals that induce depression, anxiety, fear, and despair. And negative habit thinking also lowers the serotonin level in the body, which increases depression. I just want to say one more thing about that. Good and happy thoughts of gratitude, joy, release chemicals that relax the limbic system and increase the serotonin level, given our thoughts literally determine how we feel.
By the way, years ago I got into this major argument with my sister, slammed out the door, and I stopped and I forced myself to smile. Forced it. And all of a sudden I started feeling differently. Walked back in and then we got it together and we made amends. But the point of contention was I intentionally changed the chemical reaction in my brain to induce the chemicals that I needed to get rid of that feeling.
Excellent point. I tell people, throw your body over the hurdle and the mind will follow also. Yeah.
No, absolutely, no question about it. Where the hypnosis? Where did you get your training at?
Oh, at Seton Hall University in New Jersey, and I've been doing it about 23 years. And
yeah,
you know, I talk about hypnosis is a form of meditation, so it's good for many, many things. Like 90% of serotonin is produced in the stomach, so when you relax yourself, it's good for irritable bowel syndrome. 10 minutes of hypnosis, like sleeping for 4 hours. They should really call it mesmerism, because hypnosis literally means sleep and nothing whatsoever to do with sleep. Nothing whatsoever.
Very interesting point. You have a statement. It says, beyond every emotion, there is cognition. What do we mean by that?
Yeah, behind every emotion, there's a cognition. And I give this this test in the book. And here's four questions. And these are fill in the blanks. When I'm happy, I've been thinking blank thoughts. When I'm sad, I've been thinking blank thoughts, angry blank thoughts. It's ridiculous, but the point is, you know, our thoughts, you know, behind every emotion, there's a cognition. Behind every emotion, there's a thought. Our thoughts determine how we feel. So if we're depressed, we're thinking along depressing lines, anxious lines, stressful lines. Yeah.
Okay, so the unconscious mind doesn't have a language like you and I speak right now. It has a language of pictures and symbols. Once something gets into that unconscious mind, it associates with a particular symbol, which could be a cognition, and that in turn will turn into some kind of a reaction that we're going to get based on our past history.
That's a different, yeah, that's an area, but I'm talking about a simple thing like, let's say at the moment I'm sad. Well, I'm thinking along sad lines, or I'm anxious. Something's making me anxious. You know, some people become like prisoners of their own thoughts. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think you're talking about a collective unconscious thing, a little something a little different.
Yeah. By the way, I'm not a I'm not a professional. These are just thoughts that I have coming up with questions.
That's okay.
Okay.
That's okay. I enjoy it. Yeah.
Okay. Now, one big problem that most people have is we resist change. How do you move someone through that?
Yeah. Change, at times, change can be difficult. It depends on our perception. You know, I think a definition of intelligence is the ability to adapt to old, especially new situations. So if we can adapt to our environment, I think that's intelligence. And it's how we perceive change. Talk about if we just, stress goes away when we're dead. It's how we deal with it. If I see the stressor as a threat, like change, all these horrible emotions come into play, fear, anxiety, despair, and we change it to like a challenge. It's more in our control. So, you know, like, change for many people, if they perceive it the wrong way, is scary and difficult. If you perceive it as, hey, a new opportunity in the future, who knows what's going to happen down the line, I'll do my best shot, it's a positive thing.
Okay, so in essence, it's just called flow with it. When you really come down to it. I like the word blue. Go ahead.
When you say flow, I automatically think about mindfulness, modern-day psychology. Well, I'll go back to Buddhism, really. And I think about hypnosis, too, really. But they'll never admit that when you say you're in the flow that you're hypnotized. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Now, by the way, a blueprint. I think that's an important word because everything in life is in and about a process. You know, we innately know things, but to get to that thing, the end result, you've got to move through a step-by-step process. So this is basically what the book's created?
Yes. It's towards, the idea is, you know, to be happy, have a purposeful, fulfilling life, but many people have worry, excessive undue worry, depression, anxiety, and even panic attacks. And before you can get to this state of happiness, you have to be able to conquer those states.
Yeah, no question. But the key is, you need to be held by the hand to be able to conquer. This is not something that comes automatically.
No. You need, that's right, sir. You need a plan. You need to know what to do to get to a certain goal. And this book takes you step by step. It's easy to read. It's the format is easy.
Well, there are four laws, right, that apply?
Yeah, that's correct. And the four laws, and they make sense. The first law is the law of resistance. Change the thought that's causing resistance, and there is no more. And I'll give you an example. I had a boy that a senior in school that went to and he was very religious, which is fine. But he compared himself to Jesus Christ of God all the time. And he was on two antidepressants, because if I'm jealous of somebody, God wouldn't do that. If I do this, God wouldn't do that. So he had to change that thought. Now, like thoughts attract like thoughts. If I say to myself, for example, well, he said to himself, well, I shouldn't be thinking like this. I did wrong until we're in the gutter. And then the other law, so like thoughts attract like thoughts. And the point I'm making is, if negative thoughts can attract negative thoughts, positive thoughts can attract positive thoughts. And then there's a motivational law. When you start feeling better, which the book takes you through, success breeds success. And then the last is the law of attraction. You know, a positive attitude and a way of living will attract more good things in your life. When you have the ability to look at change differently, you change the way you look at things differently.
Okay, mindfulness is a very important word, and we hear it used, reused, overused, etc. But if you come down to the essence of it, it's critical to be mindful, isn't it?
In a lot of ways. I use mindfulness in a number of ways. For anger management, we need to take the time to pause and think for a second, what's the best way for me to handle this? It's like, I call it red light, just pause for a while, and what's the best way for you to handle this? But also, if you're really mindful and you're living in the moment, you're grateful for what's going on, you observe what's going on, and you can't, and you're not thinking about guilt from the past and anxiety from the future. You're living in the moment. So there's a lot of benefits from it.
Sure. No, absolutely, no question about it. But there's so many people who probably have no concept what mindful is, and wouldn't know what you were talking about, no matter how you put it, because their world is not like that. They're constantly worried, concerned, you said it, in the past, in the present, etc. Now, the blueprint for change and happiness, where do I purchase it? Where do I get it?
Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble, and I'm not sure what this is, but Smash, I forget what it's called.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Smashwords.
Yeah. Okay, let me ask you this. Last question. Is there something that I should have asked you that I didn't, that we, the audience, need to hear, because your subject matter is extremely important?
Do I have a second?
Sure.
I think also from the book, you can learn to regulate your emotions. Like stress. If I look at stress, it goes back to threat or a challenge. It's all how you perceive things, and I guess that's basically it.
Okay. Now, website we can find you at.
Website is MedfordCounseling.com.
MedfordCounseling.com. Okay. William Maida, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it too. Thank you very much.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm Michael Dresser. I'm Michael Dresser.
I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is...
It's a wrap.